Hello and welcome to the fourth ever episode of the Squawker Football IQ podcast. I am the Squawker Head of Analysis, George Ellick, and I've got three very special guests with me today. First, we've got Greg Stobart, the Chief Football Writer at Squawker. Hi, Greg.
Hello, George. How are you?
Very well. And we've got an agent from Base Soccer, Simon Festinese. Welcome, Simon, to Squawker.
Thank you very much for having me. Hi, everyone.
And the owner of StatsBomb, Ted Knutson. Welcome, Ted.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. So we're going to get straight down to it. And I think we're going to talk today about how to win the January transfer window. That can be from a kind of a club point of view or a player's point of view or a business point of view or whatever. And I'm going to come firstly to you, Simon. I mean, as an agent, from the business point of view, how does January kind of differ to the summer window? What's the best way of approaching it? How differently do you approach it?
Well, it's very difficult to answer your first question. And I think if anyone had a clear answer, they would make a lot of money and a lot of clubs would want to hire them if they had a recipe to win the window. But in general, the January transfer window is probably more of an adjustment transfer window where clubs have identified some needs and you know, are looking to replace an injured player or players who have not really worked out in the summer. And they try to fill the gaps, but it's nothing like the summer. And for us, I would say the main thing is just preparation. As agents, we just need to collect as much information from clubs and from players between, you know, the month of August and December before the window opens.
And Greg, as someone who kind of travels around the country trying to find out the latest gossip of what's going on behind the scenes at clubs, do you get the same feeling that it's a very different window in a sense? The what's going on behind the scenes is maybe a bit more frantic?
Yeah, I think adjustment's exactly the right word, and it's why we won't, you know, you rarely see the top six doing an awful lot, and if they do, invariably it doesn't particularly work out. You think back a couple of years ago when in the January transfer window Manchester City signed Wilfried Bonny, Chelsea responded by signing Juan Cuadrado, and neither of them fitted the strategy or the team needs at the time. They just did it because they thought they had to. And yeah, I think certainly for teams in the bottom half of the Premier League, the teams looking to avoid relegation or if they've just changed the manager, there can be a lot of value in the transfer market. We've seen managers this year come in very recently and they're looking to change things. But certainly for the top clubs, it's a big risk if you make changes in January, especially when you factor in that the players got to come in and settle.
Is there not a big risk as well of spending a lot of money when you're a team towards the bottom, like we saw with Newcastle and Norwich last season, who spent big to try and stay in the Premier League, and now they're in the Championship with these players on their wage bill they can't really afford?
Yeah, and a lot of the time they're correcting, as Simon suggested, they're correcting mistakes they made in the summer, and a lot of the time it reflects a poor recruitment strategy all round, I think.
And Ted, you're someone who's worked in recruitment before. In your experience, is there a different means of searching for that important player?
The way that we worked was we always worked like months ahead, like literally months ahead. So by February, we had most of our targets done for the summertime. And so for the January window, you're partly learning about the players that you've been keeping an eye on for a while, but you're also looking to, you know, maybe sell a player that, depending on where your position is in the league table, that somebody's really interested in, and you can get a premium for that. So if you're a safe club, it actually isn't a bad time to sell. If you're a club that's looking to be relegated, you have to have done things right in the first place to potentially find the right targets. And you're probably in a relegation spot because maybe you haven't done that. So you might compound the errors that you screwed up.
But it's an interesting point you make about the forward planning. And I think that's the case kind of obviously in recruitment generally. But is it therefore something of a surprise that we don't see more of a flurry of activity at the beginning of January? I mean, we're now 2 weeks in and there have been very few deals going through, and it's probably quite likely they'll go through towards the end of the month.
I hate this. When we were involved, you hate to be last minute. But the other problem is like some windows in some countries like move much earlier. Like Germany tends to move very quickly, and they also tend to sign up a lot of guys sort of in March, Whereas, you know, Italy will often be the last day you'll see a flurry of stuff, or the last week anyway. And England tends to wait a long time too. So it's not always in your control. Sometimes you literally have to wait for everybody to be paying enough attention or to be able to get a hold of them on their phones after they're on holiday to do the work.
And Simon, obviously, you're someone who represents or tries to represent the best interest in clubs or players. Is the waiting game a way to do that? Is that because it's better for these parties to wait until the last minute in order to kind of force a club's hand?
Not always. I mean, I would say it's a case by case, but what is true is that England is part of the country, is in part of the markets where things happen very late in the windows in general, whether it's in January or in the summer. Sometimes it's also because deals are locked. You know, everyone knows there is a lot of money in the Premier League, and for a player to come from a foreign country to England, then, you know, their parent club usually expect a big sum of money that the Premier League clubs are not necessarily ready to pay at first, so they always try to wait and...
A negotiating tactic.
And negotiate, yeah, of course.
Absolutely. And Greg, in your experience, do you think that these transfers that do go through late on in the window are generally a mistake, or do you think it's just a case of, as you know, as Simon said, it might be a negotiation tactic?
In January? Not necessarily. I think, as the guy suggested, a lot of time they are... It's a matter of just waiting until the end of the window to get the best value. Sometimes it doesn't work, whether it's in the January or the summer. You know, you look back to last summer, everyone was waiting for Moussa Sissoko's price to drop, and Tottenham ended up paying 30 million on the last day of the window. So it doesn't necessarily work out, but I think it's a negotiating strategy rather than a suggestion that the clubs are flip-flopping on their targets.
Well, the other problem that you run into is that, you know, the clubs that are selling know a little bit more about their positioning. But the thing that really drives me crazy is if you wait late in August and then you wait late in January, you've basically given up 6 to 8 games of your season on late targets. Like, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever, and especially if you're towards the bottom. Like, you've got to find the target, pay the price that gets them there quickly, because those 3 games could definitely matter at the end of the season whether you're being relegated or not.
I think one of the frustrations for a lot of agents, certainly, you tell the club what it's going to cost and then they kind of ignore you anyway, and they offer a much less. And you say, look, they're not going to sell for any less than this amount, and they still won't do it. So, you know, if you know the price, sometimes you have to pay it, but, you know, it's all negotiation. There's so much money involved, and there's a contract as well. It's not, you know, deals are very rarely done in 48 hours, are they, Simon?
No, it's true. Deals take a long time to fall into place. But, you know, as Ted said earlier, some markets also work early because they're prepared better. Germany is a prime example. What Dortmund did in the summer is fantastic. It's phenomenal. They had all their business done before the window even opened.
And for highly tactical coaches,
absolutely,
that really matters as well. You get them in earlier, you get more build-up time for them. They get to, in Germany or any of the countries that have a break, you probably get 2 extra weeks of training if you get them in at the beginning of the window.
Absolutely. And you have pre-season and you have time for the players to settle in and you know, the team to gel and all that. So sometimes clubs just... You don't know what they're doing, what they're waiting for, because they don't even get in touch with us sometimes. we don't know, and we hear from them 2 weeks before it closes.
I mean, that preparation is something I definitely want to touch on with you, Ted, because I hope and I think that, you know, the way that clubs are now recruiting has developed somewhat, and they're now putting more, doing their homework a bit better, doing their due diligence a bit better. Do you feel like what metrics kind of within the analytical world are now being used properly in recruitment, and which are maybe being overexposed somewhat?
I was talking to some friends of mine about this on the overexposed or overvalued, and goals are very clearly overvalued, like, because there's a lot of variance inside of them. Basically, when last year we showed our coaches our own player, but we took the name off of it, and 1 year through an exact same number of shots, he had 3 goals. And the next year he had 10 goals, and all of the metrics that look were exactly the same, the expected goals per shot, et cetera, et cetera. And we're like, this is our player. Almost nothing has changed. And yet you guys think he's one of the best players in the league right now. And last year at this time, you thought he was fine, but not that big a deal. And this is, there's nothing that's different in this, but this is how we overvalue the player just because he's scoring goals at the moment. In the analytics side, we would say, okay, we've actually been the same on this player the entire time. And that's actually what you need to do, because you need to be look somewhat predictive. You can't just ride the wave of whether somebody's scoring or not. And that's a big challenge in recruitment. You get overexcited by a guy who's put some goals on the board, when in reality, you know, maybe he's not going to continue to do that.
Does that in a way mean that obviously whilst recruitment's generally used, analytics is generally used for finding, you know, diamonds in the rough, do you think to an extent it's therefore helping kind of the focus on goals and is sometimes helping the selling club because it means that these players who actually aren't performing too well are being sold massively overvalued. I know that Jermaine Defoe is someone at the moment who we'll talk about more in the future, but he's someone who's massively overperforming in terms of just his goals, and actually his output isn't particularly good.
Well, and partly he's got a lot of penalties as well. And Defoe is towards the last legs of his career, and so you're taking that on, you're not going to be able to sell him on. Is he going to continue to even perform at his current level? And those are other questions that you have to be aware of. I think we might be giving too much credit in terms of what's happening in the recruitment side of most clubs, though. They're not using analytics at this level. They're doing more traditional work, and very few clubs, even in the Premier League, are incorporating the statistical analysis that says that we're profiling players in this way, and this is how we do most of our transfer shopping. It's just not happening.
Have you noticed that in your experience, Simon, as an agent? Have you seen the rise or lack of use of analytics?
No, I think it's risen in the past few years, and we've seen a lot of former head of analysis going into the recruitment staff at clubs. Then it's all about how you use it more than using it or not, because you cannot replace the eyes of a scout going to watch games and the knowledge of a player over years and how he evolves through the season, the injuries he's had, and you can't just look at numbers and make your mind up on a player. So you have to complete the stats and the numbers with a feel for the player, and that you can't just replace.
Is that just finding a good relationship between analytics team and scouting team?
Yeah, and also the coaching staff, because what the coach is going to do on the pitch week in, week out is very important. How he wants to play the player, what he needs exactly, and the more open the communication channels are between the coaching staff, analytical staff, and recruitment staff, the better the recruitment will be. And sometimes it's very difficult at clubs for these different parties to communicate well.
And how, Ted, do you see that relationship? How should that be set out? I mean, how should teams be setting out to find their players?
Well, what we built was a clear hybrid process.
So at Brentford?
Yeah, at Brentford and Midtjylland as well. And Midtjylland, for them in January, it'd be their big season, their big transfer season, because they have an extended break. So we would work sort of in October for that. And we would produce a bunch of candidates that we thought might be good enough for whatever the club need was. And the challenge in modern recruitment is that coaches change all the time. So if you build like a passing team and then Sam Allardyce comes in and has a very different idea of how you want them or how he wants them to play, your recruitment may not match up with that. And that's a big challenge from the club perspective. The cost of rebuilding nowadays is monumental, even for a club like Chelsea or City, that they kind of have similar style coaches that they brought in over a period of time. But, trying to get a Bonucci or a Virgil van Dijk or whatever, like that's one player and you're looking at 50 or 60 million. And if that guy doesn't meet the next guy's needs, then suddenly you're casting him off. So it's a huge challenge in that way. What we've kind of been talking to on the consulting side to clubs is, say, what is the style of play that you want to play? Whether it's the owner that's chosen this or the director of football or whatever, you need to marry up your academy to that. And then you need to find coaching candidates that kind of match most of that style, and then supplement them with guys like, set piece coaches or things in that way, so that you can have a continual process, much more like really Southampton have done. They at least don't have huge changes and swings from coach to coach. They have an idea of what they should be doing. Their academy produces recruits that mostly match up to that. And then they supplement that with younger players from the market after selling on their successful players to other Premier League clubs for a premium.
And they still manage to sign people like Cuca Martina despite the solid foundations at the club.
I was not high on Cuca Martina, actually, and I think I said that at the time. But yes, it happens. Like, they're humans. Even Monchi, who's a fantastic recruiter and has a decade of experience and success, says that every time that we sign a player, it's a risk because we're dealing with humans. And at the end of the day, that's the truth.
Of course. And you touched on kind of the managerial merry-go-round and coaches who come and go from teams. Greg, how does that affect things going into the market? You look at right now in the Premier League, we've got Clement who's just taken over at Swansea. We've got Allardyce who's just taken over at Palace. We've got the new Hull manager as well. I mean, we've spoken about how teams should be looking for their targets a long time in advance. Will they have had to tear up what they've been doing for the last 6 months when these managers come in, or does it depend on the manager?
As we alluded to earlier, a lot of the time there's a poor recruitment strategy or not the communication in the first place. I mean, you mentioned those three clubs. And a lot of it depends on the personality of the manager and the job they come into. Sam Allardyce, just like Alan Pardew, at Palace you've got a traditional manager role. You've got recruitment staff, but there's no director of football. You work directly with the chairman. You choose your players. So it's no surprise to see Sam Allardyce going for players he's worked with before, Carl Jenkinson, Patrick Van Aanholt, those kind of players. Swansea's a bit of a weird one because Hugh Jenkins kind of works as half chairman, half director of football. It's a little bit odd. And Hull are just all over the place, and they rely massively on agents, actually, more than pretty much any other Premier League club. They go to agents and say, we need a right back, help us out, who have you got? So
Hull had huge uncertainty in the summertime. There were many rumours about potential transfer or takeover deals that they were waiting on. They changed out Steve Bruce, and so, like, I mean, that was just like the absolute worst possible
scenario. It's a car crash, isn't it? So, you know, a lot of the time...
And links to George Mendes as well, from the new manager as well, which could be interesting going forward with recruitment.
Well, like I said, they use agents pretty heavily, and they lean on some agents, so... If you're going to lean on one, George Mendes might not be the worst one in the world.
No, maybe not, especially for the short term, maybe, before it comes a graveyard of lost European talent. Today, it looks like Hull are going to make their first signing, which is an old midfielder that Marco Silva managed at Estoril in Portugal. So he's obviously having an impact there. Simon, we've touched on the risks of January, and I think there are some pretty high-profile transfer flops that have happened in the past. You look at that crazy day of Fernando Torres going to Chelsea and Andy Carroll going to Liverpool. You look at Juan Cuadrado. I think of the top 10 highest fees in January in the Premier League, Darren Bent's probably the only one you can really call a success. Does that make your job harder? I mean, do people come in with more kind of trepidation into the month?
Yeah, I mean, I think you forgot one that was a big success was Luis Suarez as well. I was looking before coming. And at the biggest fees and success or not, and I was quite surprised that actually half of the top 10 were massive flops, considering the fee that was paid, and you named a few of them. Now, you know, as agents we try to represent our clients and get them the best deals, so it doesn't necessarily make it more difficult for us. It's probably for the clubs that the headache is a bit bigger.
Certainly for the top clubs, when you're talking about the big transfer fees, a lot of the time it's expediency. I was trying to think through the big January transfers. I mean, if you look at the top six at the moment, there are a handful of players, not even that, from their first choice starting 11s that were signed in January. You know, Nemanja Matic at Chelsea, which was accelerating a summer target, really. And they'd been knocked out of the Champions League already, Benfica at the time. Gary Cahill as well. David Luiz, first time round, I don't think you'd call that a success. Arsenal signed Nacho Monreal when they had injuries, a bit like they did with Elneny last year. Dele Alli at Tottenham, who got loaned back straight to MK Dons, that doesn't really count.
Well, it's really bargain hunting. Like, if you can find a time when you can find talent, then it doesn't matter when you buy them, right? If you need them right now, that's the big challenge. And that's usually what you're seeing these big premiums put on. Like, some of those were sort of carry-ons, like the Torres move plus the Andy Carroll move. Like, it's kind of a ridiculous combination of things where the money spent didn't make that much sense for either of them, although for Torres it might have made some sense. But then, yeah, I mean, Andy Carroll's fee has always been kind of silly, and then he got pegged to that point, and he's never been that player.
No, and as well at this time, especially now, we're seeing certain players coming in from leagues that we're maybe not so used to seeing money spent on them. We've got Wilfred Ndidi, who's obviously just come from Genk to Leicester. Ted, in your experience, how is it hard to manage expectations from other leagues, is it easy to work out the strength of that league? Obviously, you see a lot of players coming from Holland who have flopped or been successful.
I think that's the biggest challenge in recruitment, period. And it's one thing that we've worked hard on numerically, but also like sort of qualitatively, like looking at where the success has come from. You need to really profile the league and the talent base there closely to understand. Like the Netherlands, you're playing mostly against young players. So it's a bit like when you take an older player in the NBA, in the NBA draft or something, and suddenly, you know, he's 22, 23, he's playing against a bunch of 19-year-olds, he's going to look better. It's physical development, period. So if you're playing in the Netherlands and you're 24 and you're really successful, maybe there's a question mark about whether you can see it in the Premier League.
There's certainly been a change. I think the January transfer window has brought media hype to this window so much now that I think during January, some football fans are more interested in who their team are going to sign as opposed to who they're going to play. Has this fan pressure, Greg, do you think that has changed the window at all? Do you think the way that now fans almost demand the big money signing means that it affects the way that clubs set out going about their business?
Yeah, well, I was actually just looking at this list Simon gave me, and second on the list is Juan Mata, who we didn't talk about, actually being something of a success. But at the time, he was signed when United had their worst start to the season in decades under David Moyes. They'd had an awful summer window when they signed Marouane Fellaini and no one else on the last day of the window. And that was a matter of Ed Woodward trying to prove that he could sign a big player, trying to appease the fans and show their ambition, sign a player from a rival as well. And it was fan pressure. And I think Woodward was very keen to get the fans on board and make that big name signing. And you see it now as well. I mean, you've got to say West Ham are the best example, really, aren't they? I mean, their communication strategy alone is just absolutely dreadful. But, you know, they spent the whole of the summer saying, we've got £30 million to sign a striker. We're going to go for Bakker. Loads of other big name signings they're going for. Batshuayi ended up getting some nobodies on loan, Zaza, you know, all these horrible, horrible signings. And then they come into January and they're doing exactly the same thing. And it's like they want to tell the fans that they're trying,
Yeah.
But they're not doing an awful lot of doing.
If you're looking for a transfer strategy that's clearly not successful, there was a guy out there who produced all of the forwards from West Ham for like the last 7 or 8 years on Twitter, and they score 1 in 5. And this is something like 25 guys. Clearly, they need help in fixing their recruitment strategy there, because that's disastrous.
And we're going to go in more in depth later on in the podcast about the strikers they are looking at. But there was an amazing, I mean, Simon, this probably was something you'd, I'm sure, not really seen before, like us, where they put a post on their website from The Insider, whoever that may be, claiming that they've made a £20 million bid for a Scottish striker, a £10 million bid for a Championship striker, and a £6 million bid for a Premier League striker, when they've been linked to, surprisingly, Moussa Dembélé, Scott Hogan, and Jermaine Defoe. Is that something that you can see taking off, clubs almost leaking to the press what their transfer strategy is? I mean, how would that affect the deals themselves?
I don't know who's responsible for that leak there. I don't know if it's a part of a strategy, if it's a mistake. I have no idea, but it is surprising.
If you were working on a deal and you saw that the club you were negotiating with had posted something like that on there on the site, do you think that would irk the club that are selling? Would it annoy you? Would it annoy the player?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it would, you know, the negotiating for a player is a game of, you know, you leak the information that will serve you, and vice versa, the club will do the same. So it's I can't believe they've done it if it's not going to serve them somehow. It seems weird.
And what was interesting is they seemed that the people in the know seem to claim that bid for Moussa Dembélé never even happened as well. So it almost looks as if, you know, it's a desperate... They're a club who've got a manager in trouble, they've got a team in trouble, and a board who are in trouble, and it just seems like maybe a Gregor cry for attention.
Yeah, it was genuinely just a way to appease the fans. Hey, look, like, you know, they've got the chairman's son on Twitter telling everyone what they're doing. They're an absolute joke of a club, really. But it's purely messaging to fans to say, hey, look... We're trying. We're sorry our team's rubbish and we got thumped by Man City, but we're trying to sign a striker for you so he can finish Payet's chances. And I think most football fans can see through that kind of nonsense.
Well, you talked a bit about whether that's sort of fan pressure, and there are some executives that just live too close to that. Like, they need to have a buffer and an objective look at what their club's needs are and what their future strategy is. And, you know, for West Ham, even looking backwards for quite a while, it's hard to find that.
Yeah, I've got an example of a chairman who gets quite a lot of heat from fans and has done over the years, but kind of ignores it and always does what he thinks genuinely is in the best interest of the club, is Daniel Levy at Tottenham. However upset the fans get, he makes decisions rationally. He thinks about it and he does what's for the best of the club. And sometimes he makes mistakes, of course he can, and he owns those mistakes and looks to correct them in the future. But certainly he's not influenced by fans, because if you're influenced by fans, you're signing a load of £30 million players every summer that aren't going to work out.
But it's an interesting point in talking about the owners. And I think that a lot of football fans fall into the trap of associating transfers with managers. And quite often it's not actually the manager who's having the final say on transfers. As an agent, do you find that who's kind of the most important representation of a club? Is it the manager, or is it generally the owner or the director of football?
It just depends on the club and how the club is organised. If, you know, we talked about Swansea, Crystal Palace, Hull City before, that they're all different clubs, and the key for us is to know and identify at each club who is going to be the final decision maker, whether it's the manager, the sports director, the chairman, owner,
yeah,
president, however you call it, who is going to sign that contract. And have the final say. So that's part of that's the biggest part of our job.
And there's obviously, whilst transfers take up kind of the main focus in the transfer window, there's always loans happening as well the whole time. Ted, obviously the things you're looking for in a loan signing are very different from a permanent signing. You've got to find a different kind of skill set from a younger player. When you're looking at players who you want to come to kind of bring in on loan, what is the difference?
Loans need to be somebody that can contribute right now, but often they're a young player that has to contribute right now, which is a very challenging evaluation process. So for also, like, if you're the loaning club, you need a place that they're going to play. And for many of these clubs, we see plenty of players that get loaned out that just don't play. Whether it's a bad fit or not, it might be a good fit, but they're like, well, we have this other player that we actually own, so we're going to play him and give him minutes. It doesn't make sense for us, or I'm not comfortable with developing someone else's player. And in some countries, there's a system that rewards both, like the Italian sort of partial ownership used to be part of that. Here, it doesn't happen in that way. And we see kids that go out for a year that just don't play at all. And it's a dead year for them. It's an awful development period.
Well, I mean, a player that I would have thought you know quite well, in Alex Pritchard, who obviously had a great loan spell at Brentford a couple of years ago. And it was this time last year where he signed. I mean, Brentford played a great brand of attacking football. Him and Alan Judge had a very good relationship. And then he went to West Brom under Tony Pulis. I mean, is that an example of, it seems a very strange move for all parties, really.
Both Pritch and Serge Gnabry went in that period of time to Tony Pulis. And there's no brand of attacking football that Tony Pulis plays that makes sense to really develop one of those top six players. Like, it doesn't match up at all. And the big clubs need to be aware of this. This is part of the success. These guys are assets, you know, and you see Liverpool selling on a lot of their academy kids for big money. But you have to pay attention to the process of development. You have to get them under coaches that are going to continue to develop them and put them in a style that makes sense for their game.
And, I mean, Pritchard wasn't the only bad loan last January. Just to name a couple more, we had Kike going to Borough, who played twice without scoring, and Juan Iturbe, obviously under much fanfare, from Roma to Bournemouth, and again made two appearances, one off the bench. So, I mean, as someone in the loan market, how does your job change there? I mean, is it, again, just a case of it's by kind of case by case, or?
Well, I think, it is case by case, and Ted was spot on. It's a very difficult market because you need to make sure you find the right club for your player, where he's going to play, where the manager is going to trust him to play week in, week out. And why would a club having players on loan develop young players for other clubs without getting any rewards for it? So there are certainly ways to look into it and try to reward the club where the player goes on loan. If it's successful and then he goes on and have a successful career, then, you know, the club should get something for it.
Maybe a tiny sell-on fee. There's also the way that a lot of the German clubs do, where the more the player plays, the less of their salary you have to cover, which is also quite a sensible way of giving a financial incentive.
That's exactly right. And there are a lot of ways to look into to make it a bit easier. Then you know, that's for young players. Then you have the other question of more senior player going on loans. And most of the time, if they're going on loan, it's because they're not playing at their parent club. So why are they not playing? Is it because they're out of form? They're not, you know, it's just a tactical thing with the current manager. So it's not always guaranteed that a loan will be a success. It's a big gamble.
And Spurs are a team. We've mentioned Pritchard, who approach loans somewhat differently. And you've got to wonder whether or not, Greg, they actually use loans to develop players or just to get them out the door, really. Because it seems like the younger Spurs players who they rate seem to stay under Pochettino's wing.
I think it's going to become more and more the case, even at a club like Chelsea, really, when you've got managers who have such defined tactical methods and ways of working. If Mauricio Pochettino loans you out, it usually means that's you done at Tottenham, because you've seen it with Alex Pritchard and a few others. He's kept around the likes of Harry Winks and Josh Onuma because he wants them training with the first team every day, getting imbued in his style of play, the mentality that he's trying to build at the club. If you're sent out on loan, it probably means they want you in the shop window for 6 months and then to sell you in the summer.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that if you do that with all of those players, what happens is they don't get playing time, and they really need playing time. There's a very distinct point at which it's much more valuable for players to be on the pitch and learning in those dynamic situations than it is to just be under another coach for another 6 months. And the complicated thing now is with the loan window change so that it matches up with the transfer window. Back in the summertime, a lot of those kids didn't get loaned because I guess either the clubs overlooked it or they didn't realize how much work it would be. Usually it would happen that, you know, there was a 3 or 4 week break and then there would be the young player loan period. And that doesn't happen now. And so it places a lot more burden on player evaluation and choosing those loans correctly as well. for great coaches, like, it's super important to have them. But at some point, players got to play.
Yeah, I think the point with Pritchard, Spurs still managed to sell him for £8 or £9 million to Norwich last summer. But that was more thanks to the Brentford loan than anything he did at Tottenham or West Brom.
And becoming known as a place where players will get to play and you trust them to play inside your squad has a big benefit, because those big clubs look at you and they say, okay, you're a good shepherd for these younger players. Even if you change managers over time, they know that the administration up above it is going to make sure that those guys get some playing time.
And just to add something on what Ted said, it's not only players need to play, they need to play competitively. Because, you know, the Premier League has been looking at doing the Premier League under-21s that became under-23s last summer. And playing in these games has nothing to do with playing in a League One or League Two, you know, side where you're playing with adults and they compete for their spot and their life is on the line because they play for 3 points. And for them, you know, it
and
makes a big difference.
And those teammates care. Those guys
absolutely
care.
Absolutely. So that you can't replace for a young player. They need to get out and play regularly. You can't just expect them to develop without that.
Well, we had Dan Bond in the last podcast, for those who heard it, who's a performance analyst at Oxford United, who have a very good reputation for getting talent in. I had the likes of Dan Crowley from Arsenal in recently. And you look at someone like Kemal Roof, who they got in, who went on loads of loans at West Brom without really playing, and then came to Oxford about age 21, has 18 months there, and sold him for £3 million to Leeds. And it just shows, I think, the what first team football can really do to a player.
Yeah, and I think another thing for these players, you both alluded to, is the mentality as well. It's playing with men. And I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but if you go to the academies at Chelsea, Arsenal, Tottenham, Man City, it's like Disneyland, honestly. You know, it's a completely different world. So, you know, to do 6 months or a season at a top championship club, massive for them mentally. And, they're, you know, we talked about Tottenham not loaning players out, but Harry Kane's success story, a massive part of it is down to all those loan moves.
Yeah. Well, it's also good for them to get perspective. Like, this is what it's like in the lower leagues. And if you don't work hard, like, you will be here. And some of these guys, this is the best they can do, and that's great. But for you, hopefully, you've got more potential, but you've got to work hard to realise it.
Crowley's a good point of that, who's someone who Arsenal bought as a kind of mid-teenager from Aston Villa. And he's had a loan spell at Barnsley, which was cut short, a loan spell at Oxford, which has been cut short as well. And he's gone on loan to Go Ahead Eagles in Holland and been sent off in his first game. And you've got the feeling that that's not a player who's developing on loan.
Preston North End have done a good job of recovering guys that came up in those systems, like Callum Robertson, Daniel Johnson. They've got Pearson as well, that used to be at Man United. So like, there's a value point for clubs that are also looking at the guys that have talent but haven't quite realized it before they come out of the academy system.
So we're going to move on now, after that fascinating chat about loans, to talk about what's going on right now. And sadly, we have had to record this due to our very busy schedules on the 12th of January, and it won't be going out until the 17th, I think. So therefore, we may be a little bit behind the time, so do forgive us if we're waxing lyrical about a player who's on his way somewhere and he's ended up going somewhere else in the meantime. We're going to start with the team at the top of the table, Greg. Is it not a surprise that the team who is blowing everyone else away in the league, it seems to be the one linked to the most players, and that's Chelsea?
Well, I think Conte wanted players and he still needs players. You look at that first choice starting 11, and it's not hard to think of an upgrade on Gary Cahill or Victor Moses. Nevertheless, when you see the names being linked, the likes of Mikel Antonio, Jonas Hector, it doesn't make an awful lot of sense when they're not in Europe. He's relying on 13 or 14 players at the moment, basically. It's his first 11 plus Fabregas and Willian and Zouma. You'd say now he's fit and that's about it. But, you know, really, if I was Antonio Conte, I'd wait until the summer when there's far more value to be had in the market. Chelsea will be in the Champions League next year as well, so they can sign top quality European experienced players that they're not going to be able to get at the moment. To see Chelsea sort of almost scattergun just to try and sign someone, I don't really see the sense in it, especially when they brought Nathan Aki back, which is a loan that did work out as well.
I think that it's mostly just transfer rumours. Like, it's just media stuff. I don't think there's much legitimate fire behind it. If they find a guy like Kessie or something that they can lock up for the summertime, they probably will. One problem that Chelsea have, is going back to the loans point that we just got off of, is a guy like Mishy only has 84 minutes in the league. And, you know, he's not going to play because they don't have the extra minutes to go around. Because they're not in Europe, they just don't need to rotate their squad nearly to the same point. And so it's actually an interesting challenge, because Chelsea have so many good young players all around Europe. They have to make sure that they also get playing time. And Mishy came in and they thought he was going to, you know, at least be a regular, you know, sub 84 minutes says that it's anything but that, and it won't change much in the second half.
I think that the obviously Premier League squads are so competitive now. And Simon, in your role, if a club comes in for a player, is there a concern in the player's side that they're not going to get the game time they want? And does that prove a stumbling block?
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, if you're looking to move a player in January, it's usually a player who is not playing at his club anyway. But just, you know, going back to Chelsea, if you look at Chelsea over the past few years, they're the team that spent the most in January. But they're also the team that sold the most. So, you know, in that case, you need to look at the business model. And it seems to be at Chelsea, they seem to move a lot of players in and out. And they're really trying to get some good opportunities, get them some exposure, and maybe sell them for a big sum of money after. And they've been quite successful at doing that in the last few years. So why not keep going?
And it seems one position, I mean, I think it's fair to say that over the next kind of year, 18 months, I'll look to upgrade on those two wide players, in Alonso and Moses. But it looks like they're trying kind of more actively to find a midfielder to play alongside Kante, maybe someone a bit more mobile than Nemanja Matic, who is having a good season, but he maybe lacks the legs of some of the younger players they've been linked to in Europe. Frank Kessie being one of them, who's at Atalanta, and Tomori Bakayoko from Monaco. Are these players you know much about, Ted? Have you looked at their output?
I've looked at Kessie quite a bit. Atalanta have done quite well in Serie A this year, unusually so. And so I've watched quite a bit of them. I like him, a big, big body. He looks like he's going to be a talent. Right now, I don't think that he's good enough to upgrade their midfield, but I don't think this is a purchase necessarily for right now. It might be for 2 years from now. And that's another thing that a lot of the smart clubs do. Like they invest in talent that they can get at the moment for, say, 15 or 20 million, so that 2 years from now, they're not paying 40 or 50 million for a guy that's already become successful and is the hot product on the market. But you got to trust your recruitment process in order to do that.
And the, you know, the breaking news with us, so nearly a week old news for you guys, is that Dimitri Payet is refusing to play, according to Slaven Bilic in his press conference this morning, will be refusing to play for West Ham. Greg, what do you make of this? I mean, is he someone who's going to go to a Champions League club and flourish in his late years, or is he just looking for a last payday?
Well, I don't think it's a surprise that he wants to leave. I think he wanted to leave in the summer and West Ham blocked it, moving to the stadium. He had great Euros, Paris Saint-Germain, Real Madrid were being linked with him as well, and West Ham have been awful, and just his body language on the pitch tells you that he is not happy at the moment. You know, they told him they were going to sign a £30 million top quality striker, and he ended up with Zaza and Ayu and Carroll. So I can understand why he's unhappy. I can't see him being sold in January. I mean, clubs, you know, I think the last few years there has been a little bit of shift. When clubs say no, they mean no, whether it's Southampton, West Brom or Tottenham or Man United or West Ham, and I think they'll look to make a stand, make a point and keep him till the summer. Certainly I can't see him going to one of the top six Premier League clubs. I can't see him going to PSG or Real. Marseille haven't got the money to pay him £125,000 a week, so unless there's an enormous offer from China, which isn't impossible, I think he'll stay until the end of the season.
And a thing to point out about Payet is people seem to think that he's dropped off this season, but actually lots of his output has improved. He's creating more chances this season. His assists are slightly down, and he was just blowing unbelievably hot with his free kicks last season. So it's not surprising that his goal scoring has dropped off a bit. But he's created over 35% of West Ham's chances this season, which is comfortably the highest in the league. Simon, when a player does throw their toys out of the pram like the Frenchman seems to have done, is it easy to force through a move behind the scenes? Is this something that he'll be able to do, or if a club holds firm, it will become pretty messy?
No, it's never easy, and I don't know much about the, you know, inside of this situation, so it's difficult to speak specifically on that case. But you know, we can't forget that players have contracts and they're employed by the clubs, and you know, in any other business, if you have an employer and you're under contract, then you know, you have to respect some obligations.
But the club have to respect that too. They don't have full control. Someone like Julian Draxler, who didn't move in the summer as well, and then moves now. Like, you can ruin your club atmosphere, for starters. Like, the dressing room matters. And these guys, if they're angry, like, that causes a problem there. You can also ruin the value of the asset. If somebody's offering you $50 million for a guy that wants to leave, and you keep him, and something goes wrong, then suddenly he's $30
million. And absolutely.
That's a huge cost.
No, and that was I was you know, going to go on and say, if that's true for the player, it's also true for the employer and the club, and they also have some obligations. And sometimes you see stories where, you know, players are sent to train with the under 23s, and they're, you know, when clubs try to move a player who doesn't want to go, they can make their life very difficult. So it's always very, you know, without knowing exactly what's going on and what the situation is, it's difficult to judge who is right or wrong in the in this specific case. But it looks like he wants to move, and he will do everything he can to get the move. Now, will West Ham, you know, hold on to him? And they're certainly financially able to do it. Now, you know, most Premier League clubs can hold on to their players if they want to. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a waiting game and very difficult times for him.
I think it's very dangerous for them to hold on to him for the exact reason that you mentioned. So much of their attack goes through him. If they keep him and he's not happy, then what does that do to their performance? And if they get rid of them, then what does that do to their performance?
And surely your first point may be what's happened this season. They have kept all of them unhappy. And whilst he is playing well, their performances have massively, massively dropped off. I mean, no one's, you know, putting away the chances that he's creating. And they have brought in a player who they're going to be looking to do that. He may not be the big name that Dimitri Payet was hoping for, but they have, you know, are going to spend a lot of money on him. And that's Scott Hogan, someone that Ted, you must know a fair bit about. He was brought from Rochdale to Brentford and was injured for the best part of 2 years, I think, before coming back. And he's had an incredible kind of 6 or 7 months since he returned from injury at the back end of last season. It's a big step up. Do you think he's got what it takes to be the marksman that West Ham are crying out for?
I'm not sure. And part of that is mostly a stylistic reason. Like, Brentford kind of play right now in a style that's very conducive to Scott, which is he's able to play off the last man, play a lot of through balls to him, knowing that he's going to go on to those. He also is kind of a shoot on sight right now. Not saying that that's the only thing that he can do, but he's the primary scorer, and that's how they treat him. Bilic's style isn't the same as that. And so there's always an issue of adapting to a style. In general, though, I mean, Scott Hogan is one of the two best strikers in the championship. And so that almost all merits the cost by itself, which is usually going to be 12 to 15 million right now.
Dwight Gale being the other, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Or, okay, good.
I mean, at least in scoring terms.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. A team who seem to really need some new players but aren't really being linked with many is Man City. Virgil van Dijk seems to be the only name that they're really being linked with. Holger Badstuber was being linked, but he's now gone to Schalke. Surely they need to bring in some fullbacks.
They keep saying they're happy at City, and Guardiola keeps saying in his press conference at the moment, again, like we say, that finding value in the transfer market is difficult. And Guardiola is a coach who wants a full pre-season to hammer them on the training ground. If you sign for Guardiola in January, you're not going to, you know, it's going to take you 2 months to get any kind of semblance of his style and his system. So I think it makes a lot of sense for them to wait until the summer in those terms, presuming that they can qualify for the Champions League. You know, if there's a risk of missing out on the top four, they might have to take a gamble. Van Dijk's an interesting one. I'm starting to think he won't leave in January,
especially with Fonte being
I think Southampton would sell Fonte, but I think they're pretty keen to keep Van Dijk until the summer. They don't want to break up their whole central defence. It would cost 45 million plus, and I think there is a little bit of an issue with his agents as well. Actually, he just changed his agent.
Hope that's not you, Simon.
No, it's not. Simon wishes it was him. I think he's just changed his agent, and maybe it would suit all parties more if that move happened in the summer.
My guess for what City are doing is quietly shopping around for deals to make in the summer, but they're going to try and lock those up now. And so presuming that their recruitment process is at a point that they're comfortable with, they would look around and say maybe Ricardo Pereira at Nice is somebody that they want. So they'll be talking to Nice about a potential summer move so that nothing gets messed up. But they also end up on the targets that they want and get most of that done as early as possible. Because as you said, Guardiola wants them in from the start. And that's how it was in Germany as well. Like, pretty much all of Bayern's business was always done at the beginning. I think the big problem for City right now is the lack of Gundogan. And whether he's ever going to be fully healthy throughout a season. Like, basically, we've taken Yaya, who is ostracized to some extent. And, you know, that might have been an instigation for him to get in shape. Fair enough. And now he's back. And now he's like the only truly dynamic central midfielder that they have at whatever age that he's at.
I've been thinking about this about Yaya. I mean, I think they would have accepted a big bid from China in January, yeah, but now
they can't.
What can they do? They've got to keep him.
There's a thinking that him scoring two goals on his return is almost the worst thing that could have happened to them now, because he's back in the team playing regularly. And since he's come back in, their form's tailed off pretty spectacularly until obviously the big win against West Ham. But I think anyone fancies a chance against West Ham. A couple of quite interesting transfers that have made people sit up and think, kind of, huh? Yeah, we've got Jeffrey Schlupp, who's been linked to Palace. And supposedly Leicester turning down a £9 million bid for a player that they've only started once in the Premier League this season and was a very bit part player in their title-winning campaign last season. Does that surprise you, Simon, as someone who kind of knows the financial side a bit better than us, that that's the kind of the going rate for a winger who hasn't played much for a year?
Well, he hasn't played much, but that would be strengthening a rival. So, you know, they don't want to sell on the cheap, certainly. £9 million is not a lot of money for a Premier League club. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think I can understand Leicester's game there.
And Ted, you know, Umar Nias, who was brought in one of the worst ever, probably January transfers last summer, who has been ostracised at Everton, and he's now being linked to a move to Hull. You've got to wonder what the thinking behind this pursuit of him is from Hull, surely.
Hull is kind of a thing where anyone will do that looks somewhat promising. He was quite successful in Russia. The problem is that almost no Russian transfers out of Russia have been successful elsewhere in recent years. Hull need help, though. So that's kind of understandable. And maybe if they need to swap out Snodgrass, they don't have a big squad. They don't have a very talented squad. They're kind of stuck between the Championship and the Premier League in terms of quality. And a lot of that comes back to the dysfunction that we talked about in the summertime.
And one team who are looking to strengthen hugely kind of further forward on the pitch is Everton. Obviously losing Yannick Bolasie for, I think it's now going to be a year. It was a massive and a very cruel blow to them. He's one of their standout performers when he was playing. And they brought in Adama Lookman from Charlton, who looks an incredibly exciting talent for them, who will, you'll hope, get it straight into the team in Bolasie's absence. And that's meant to Gerard Deulofeu moving on. This kind of a transfer of a player going from Barcelona to Everton then to AC Milan wouldn't have seemed possible 10 years ago. It's the kind of the changing view of world football. How has this transfer of Deulofeu not worked out? He had a great loan spell there. He still looks a player, and yet Koeman hasn't really given him a chance. He's only made 4 starts in the league this season.
It's consistency, isn't it? I mean, he comes on for 20 minutes and quick feet, and he does something, and he's a match of the day player, that's for sure. You watch him in the highlights, or you watch him 15, 20 minutes and he looks fantastic. I think he'll actually tear it up in Serie A, you know, slightly slower league, less physical. I mean, he's very, very quick. I think it would actually suit him really well. But I like what Everton are doing, actually, in terms of winning the January transfer window. You know, Lookman, fantastic, exciting young player who they had a lot of competition for. He'll go there and play. I mean, we mentioned Dele Alli right at the start. It's not too dissimilar to that. Exciting young player from the lower leagues who's got the potential to explode. And Morgan Schneiderlin, you know, picking off the scraps of a very good Premier League proven player from one of the top 4 or 5 clubs in the country. So if they can get Memphis Depay as well, I think it'd be a fantastic window for them.
Does that seem... To you, Ted, Memphis for Deulofeu, was that a fair swap?
That's not a swap. might be some thievery there, I don't know. I really like the Schneiderlin transfer. He was actually very, very good for the last 2 years. People forget. And there's this concept that if a player isn't playing, they're not very good. Like, that's just not true. There are plenty of reasons that managers don't want to play guys for what... Like, if you look at Jose, people are like, oh, well, you know, maybe he wanted time to figure out if Schneiderlin or Depay fit into his plans. If he didn't know, they would have played more. And they got almost no minutes in and around the league. Deulofeu is a bit of that, too, and we don't know why, but he's kind of run through some other managers as well, despite fantastic statistical output. Deulofeu is one of the best young creative wide players in any of the leagues in Europe. So the question is, why hasn't he settled anywhere? And, you know, how can he find a home that fits him? I hope you're right. In AC Milan, he's going to go down to Montella, and who also, you know, needs a bit more creativity. AC Milan's attack has not been very good so far. We'll see how he does. I'm rooting for him just because, like, his talent profile from a very young age looks awesome, and you want that type of guy to succeed.
One thing we didn't mention right at the start of the pod, George, which might apply if you're looking to sign Deulofeu if you're AC Milan, for example, is the personality profiling as well. And, you know, that's getting deeper and deeper. And, you know, I know one of the Manchester clubs, they hire private investigators to go and spy on players out in Spain for a few days to find out what they're getting up to make sure.
Is that our first ever football IQ exclusive? Yeah.
But no, but they do, because it's so important, you know. Well,
there's a story about Arsenal doing that with Alexis as well, like seeing how he eats. That's actually a big thing for a lot of clubs. And the consultancy that I'm just starting with on my side, we actually have access to a company that does background reports, and it's hugely important. And it's actually totally normal in the United States to go through this, but for some reason in Europe, it's almost unheard of. And if you're not doing this with 10 million pound players on average, you're just missing out on a huge trick and something very important for your club and whether or not this player is going to be settled at your place or even a good influence around the camp. Like that's, there was one guy that I send out and we've anonymized it, but it is the most appalling thing. We almost signed him. And I don't think there are any rumors, so I'm not going to give it away. But it was one of those cases where like, oh yeah, loves to take his teammates out late nights to the clubs, bottle service, regularly.
This sounds familiar.
Yes, exactly.
Regularly. George.
Obviously, it's not just Europe. Like it happens in MLS too. I've heard horror stories there too. And guys are like, man, if we knew now what we, or we knew then what we know now, we never would have signed this guy. And it happened. You have to do your due diligence.
But and Simon, is that something, have you, obviously naming no names, have you ever seen transfer talks break down because a certain player hasn't got the personality to that a manager's looking for?
Yeah, obviously. But, you know, what's very surprising, and I think this is a very interesting point, is we're mentioning these transfers that, you know, are multi-million pounds gambles. And due to regulations, most of the time, no one at the buying club is able to talk to the player until after the deal is signed.
Yeah, the numbers have to be agreed.
Exactly. So obviously, you know, in practice, this you can imagine the clubs try to get to meet the players before and talk to them because, again, if you compare it to any other industry, you would not invest that much money on someone before. You know, it's great to do profiling and see what they eat and how they behave and all that. But until you talk to someone and get a feel for him and what he's like as a human being, is he going to fit in your team, in your club? What values does he have? It seems very difficult to get a good idea on the player. So that's a thing to look into.
And that's it. Is that not legally very difficult? I mean, if you're tabling a bid for someone, but you want to talk to them before you sign them.
Well, technically, you need approval from your parent club. If both clubs agree, no problem. But as you can imagine, parent clubs most of the time want to first agree a number before. So it is a tricky situation, and it's certainly a funny situation. And you know, there were stories. I mean, you guys must love them with, you know, players at night going to in a dark alley trying to meet a manager and coming out of a car with a hoodie on, and it's.
Yes.
The transfer season is crazy. Like we had a guy named Vaclav Kadlec who went to Michelin last year, and it was quiet right up until the point that someone took a picture of him doing a VO2 test in a window at some doctor's office. And then they took a photo because this was happened to be in and around Michelin. And they're like, oh, well, he must be coming. And you're like, oh, well, yeah, that's probably true. Can't really deny that one.
And somehow still not the most disastrous doctor's test we've had in the last few months of football. And I mean, the last player we'll talk about before we move on to a quick bit of fun at the end is talking about winning the transfer window. I think that if the Belfodil transfer goes through to Everton from Standard Liège, I think we can announce Standard Liège as the transfer window winners, picking up a player for a free 6 months ago and then selling him for 12 million quid. I mean, that's got to be the dream, basically, with most transfers, Simon. That's what you're looking for is, at the end of the day, produce on the pitch and then resale value.
Absolutely. And hopefully for his agent, he put in something there when he signed for free at Standard Liège. But that's great business for them.
Absolutely. So finally, I'm going to go around our three experts here and ask them, if you had £50 million to spend on transfers, which Premier League club would you trust to spend it wisely? And then I will ask whose transfer policy you see as being the most baffling. So firstly, Greg, who would you give your £50 million war chest to?
I'm going to get there early and say Southampton. For me, they've got the best recruitment strategy, the most well-run. You think that a couple of years ago and last year, they lose two or three of their best players every single summer, and they manage to replace them with young gems much cheaper who then explode, and they can strengthen the team in other areas. Even when they've lost two coaches in the last 3 years as well, and they've still managed to get through that. I just think they're a very well-run club, and you know, they're statistically, they pretty comfortably the seventh best team in the country as well at the moment. And I think that's pretty much all down to their recruitment strategy.
Very, very compelling answer. What can we add to that? Simon, who would you?
I mean, I was going to go for Southampton, but if you are asking me if the £50 million were mine, I would probably go for Arsenal because it would probably not be spent. But no,
Arsenal fan over here.
I think Southampton over the years have been great at you know, their recruitment staff has done a great job. So yeah, Southampton.
That's the thing with Southampton. You know, if they do lose Van Dijk, they'll find a way. They'll be able to replace him. They'll be able to strengthen in other areas. They'll be okay. You don't worry that it's all going to fall apart. I mean, that summer in 2014, when half their squad went to Liverpool and they lost Pochettino, I thought they were going to be done. And the way they've responded to it has been absolutely amazing.
And they do seem to be a club who've what we spoke about earlier, Ted. They've nailed the you know, the strength of other leagues. You look at the players they brought in, and they have been from weaker leagues. You've got Van Dijk coming in from Scotland,
yep.
Obviously, and you've got Charlie Austin, who obviously, having been a Premier League striker, came in from the Championship. You know, they seem to be able to back themselves to choose players who will perform. Ted, you're 50 million now.
I give it to Arsenal. I think Arsenal consistently do a really good job in finding value. They have basically nobody that completely washes out. Occasionally, they'll have ones that are slightly underperforming, but then you get the guys like Joel Campbell that bought for 500,000 and, you know, is like a 10 to 15 million player. Arsenal also have a very strong quant side that is involved in their recruitment and that contributes to it. They may be a little old, and so we might see them need to make some more moves in the coming couple years, but overall, I think they've done quite a good job. Obviously, Southampton are great, but I will say that plenty of the moves that Southampton made, like other places saw that too. They just happened to be the ones that landed them.
So Southampton and Arsenal are the people who...
Liverpool are doing okay at the moment as well.
Now.
Yeah.
Now. I don't know what changed in the last couple of years.
And so now we'll get to the team you wouldn't trust to be spending your money. Greg, I'm coming back to you.
Hull. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty hard to sell anyway, isn't it? You know, go to Hull and battle relegation and jump between the Championship and the Premier League. But
have you been to Hull?
I have. So I'm speaking from experience. I don't think there is a strategy, which is the problem. I mean, they've just changed their manager again. But even when, you know, whether it's Steve Bruce or Mike Phelan, they haven't had a strategy, and I don't really think they know what they're doing at the moment.
Yeah, well, with £50 billion, you could buy a pretty good Championship team, which I think is what they're going to need to do. Simon, who would you?
Yeah, I wish I had been speaking first, but certainly, yeah, Hull. But and simply because the club doesn't seem organised, and you don't know. I mean, who is making the decisions and what's their process? So yeah, I wouldn't certainly trust them with my money.
To be fair to Hull, they actually did come up last year. So like they had some success in the last couple of years. I thought long and hard about this because there are some clubs you're like, man.
I was just thinking I should have said West Ham.
We talked a lot about West Ham. Like, it was between West Ham and Swansea for me. And Swansea for the last 2 years have just had blank after blank. And they basically took themselves from being one of those kind of top eight clubs. And through poor recruitment more than anything else, it seems like they're now very much struggling. And you know, they brought in Daniel Altman, who's an analytics consultant, to help out with that. They've got American owners that, you know, they keep shooting themselves in the foot for whatever reason on the PR side. But Swansea have had real problems. But I mean, if you're looking at just pure waste, it's got to be West Ham.
So for consistency's sake, I would give my £50 million to Southampton, and I would not trust my money with Manchester City.
Oh, that's a pretty good call.
I mean, they'd spend it on one player, but
they would get half a player.
I'd get a half an injured 29-year-old. That's not really what I'm after.
The busts at Manchester City have also been massive, like the Mangala.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
that's not a bad call. I like it.
So that brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks very much for listening. Thank you, Greg, for joining us.
Cheers, George.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you, guys.
And thank you, Ted. Check out StatsBomb if you want to, if you like what you heard from Ted and read some of his stuff. And please tune in to our next podcast, which will be in 2 weeks' time.